She glanced around the office. The sunbeams had crawled an inch across the desk. She saw Chester Stone, inert, Marilyn trembling, Curry, white in the face and breathing hard next to her, the guy with the shotgun, relaxed. Reacher would break him in half without even thinking about it. She saw Tony, his eyes fixed on hers, and Hobie, caressing his hook with his manicured hand, smiling at her, waiting. She turned and looked at the closed door. She imagined it bursting open with a crash and Jack Reacher striding in through it. She wanted to see that happen. She wanted it more than she'd ever wanted anything.
Okay, she whispered. I'll call him.
Hobie nodded. Tell him I'll be here a few more hours, but tell him if he wants to see you again, he better come quick. Because you and I have a little date in the bathroom. About 30 minutes from now. She shuddered and pushed off the glass table and stood upright. Her legs were weak and her shoulders were on fire. Hobie came around and took her elbow and led her to the door, led her over behind the reception counter. This is the only telephone in the place, he said. I don't like telephones. He sat down in the chair and pressed 9 with the tip of his hook, handed the phone across to her. Come closer, so I can hear what he says to you. Marilyn deceived me with the phone, and I'm not gonna let that happen to me again. He made her stoop down and put her face next to his. He smelled of soap. He put his hand in his pocket and came out with the tiny revolver Tony had slipped in there. He touched it to her side. She held the phone at an angle with the earpiece upward between them. She studied the console. There was a mass of buttons, a speed dial facility for 911. She hesitated for a second, and then dialed her own home number. It rang 6 times, 6 long, soft purrs. With each one, she willed him, be there, be there. But it was her own voice that came back to her from her machine. He's not there, she said blankly. Hobie smiled. That's too bad, he said. She was stooped over next to him, numb with shock.
He's got my mobile, she said suddenly. I just remembered.
Okay, press 9 for a line. She dabbed the cradle and dialed 9, and then her mobile number. It rang 4 times. 4 loud, urgent electronic squawks. Each one she prayed, answer, 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 answer. Then there was a click in the earpiece. Hello? He said. She breathed out.
Hi, Jack, she said.
Hey, Jody, he said. What's new?
Where are you?
She realized there was urgency in her voice. It made him pause. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, he said. Just flew down. I had to go to the NPRC again, where we were before.
She gasped. St. Louis?
Her mouth went dry. You okay? He asked her. Hobie leaned across and put his mouth next to her ear. Tell him to come right back to New York, he whispered. Straight here, soon as he can. She nodded nervously and he pressed the gun harder against her side.
Can you come back? She asked. I sort of need you here as soon as possible.
I'm booked on the 6 o'clock, he said. Gets me in around 8:30 East Coast time. Will that do? She could sense Hobie grinning next to her.
Can you make it any time sooner? Like, maybe right away?
She could hear talking in the background. Major Conrad, she guessed. She remembered his office. Dark wood, worn leather, the hot Missouri sun in the window. Sooner, he said. Well, I guess so. I could be there in a couple of hours, depending on the flights. Where are you?
Come to the World Trade Center, South Tower, 88th floor, okay?
Traffic will be bad. Call it 2.5 hours. I'll be there.
Great, she said.
You okay? He asked again. Hobie brought the gun around into her view.
I'm fine, she said. I love you.
Hobie leaned over and hit the cradle with the tip of his hook. The earpiece clicked and filled with dial tone. Jody put the phone down slowly and carefully onto the console. She was shattered with shock and disappointment, numb, still stooped over the counter, one hand laid flat on the wood propping her weight, the other hand shaking in the air an inch above the phone.
2.5 hours,
Hobie said to her with exaggerated sympathy.
Well, it looks like the cavalry ain't going to arrive in time for you, Mrs. Jacob.
He laughed to himself and put the gun back in his pocket, got out of the chair and caught the arm that was supporting her weight. She stumbled and he dragged her towards the office door. She caught the edge of the counter and held on tight. He hit her, backhanded, with the hook. The curve caught her high on the temple and she lost her grip on the counter. Her knees gave way, and she fell, and he dragged her to the door by the arm. Her heels scuffed and kicked. He swung her around in front of him and straight-armed her back into the office. She sprawled on the carpet, and he slammed the door.
Back on the sofa,
he snarled. The sunbeams were off the desk. They were inching around the floor and creeping across the table. Marilyn Stone's splayed fingernails were vivid in their light. Jody crawled on her hands and knees and pulled herself up on the furniture and staggered all the way back to her place alongside Curry. She put her hands back where they'd been before. There was a narrow pain in her temple. It was an angry throb, hot and alien where the metal had thumped against bone. Her shoulder was twisted. The guy with the shotgun was watching her. Tony was watching her, the automatic pistol back in his hand. Reacher was far away from her, like he had been most of her life. Hobie was back at the desk, squaring the stack of equity certificates into a pile. They made a brick 4 inches tall. He butted each side in turn with the hook. The heavy engraved papers slid neatly into place.
UPS will be here soon, he said happily. Then the developers get their stock and I get my money, and I've won again. About 30 minutes, probably, and then it's all over for me and for you.
Jody realized he was talking to her alone. He had selected her as a conduit for information. Curry and the Stone couple were staring at her, not him. She looked away and gazed down through the glass at the rug on the floor. It had the same pattern as the faded old item in DeWitt's office in Texas, but it was much smaller and much newer. Hobie left the brick of paper where it was and walked around behind the square of furniture and took the shotgun away from the guy holding it.
Go bring me some coffee, he said to him.
The guy nodded and walked out to the lobby, closed the door gently behind him. The office went silent. There was just tense breathing and the faint rumble of the building underneath it. The shotgun was in Hobie's left hand. It was pointing at the floor, swinging gently back and forth through a tiny arc, a loose grip. Jody could hear the rub of metal on the skin of his hand. She saw Curry glancing around. He was checking Tony's position. Tony had stepped back a yard. He had put himself outside the shotgun's field of fire, and he was aiming directly across it at a right angle. His automatic was raised. Jody felt Curry testing the strength in his shoulders. She felt him moving. She saw his arms bunching. She saw him glance ahead at Tony, maybe 12 feet in front of him. She saw him glance left at Hobie, maybe 8 feet to the side. She saw the sunbeams, exactly parallel with the brass edges of the table. She saw Curry push up onto his fingertips.
No!
She breathed. Leon had always simplified his life with rules. He had a rule for every situation. As a kid, they had driven her crazy. His catch-all rule for everything from her term papers to his missions to legislation in Congress was, do it once and do it right. Curry had no chance of doing it right, no chance at all. He was triangulated by 2 powerful weapons. His options were non-existent. If he jumped up and hurdled the table and headed for Tony, he would catch a bullet in the chest before he was even halfway there, and probably a shotgun blast in the side as well, which would kill the stone couple along with himself. And if he headed for Hobie first, then maybe Tony wouldn't fire for fear of hitting his boss, but Hobie would fire for sure, and the shotgun blast would shred Curry into 100 small pieces, and she was in a direct line right behind him. Another of Leon's rules was, hopeless is hopeless, and don't ever pretend it ain't.
Wait!
She breathed. She felt a fractional nod from Curry, and she saw his shoulders go slack again. They waited. She stared down through the glass at the rug and fought the pain minute by minute. Her torn shoulder was shrieking against her weight. She folded her fingers and rested on her knuckles. She could hear Marilyn Stone breathing hard opposite her. She looked defeated. Her head was resting sideways on her arms, and her eyes were closed. The sunbeams had moved away from parallel and were creeping towards her edge of the table.
"What the hell is that guy doing out there?" Hobie muttered. "How long does it take to fetch me a damn cup of coffee?"
Tony glanced at him, but he made no reply. Just kept the automatic held forward, favoring Curry more than anybody. Jody turned her hands and leaned on her thumbs. Her head throbbed and burned. Hobie kicked the shotgun up and rested the muzzle on the back of the sofa in front of him. He brought the hook up and rubbed the flat of the curve over his scars.
"Christ," he said. "What's taking so long? Go give him a hand, okay?"
Jody realized he was looking straight at her.
"Me? Why not? Make yourself useful. Coffee is woman's work, after all."
She hesitated.
"I don't know where it is," she said.
"Then I'll show you."
He was staring at her, waiting. She nodded, suddenly glad to get a chance just to move a little. She straightened her fingers and eased her hands backward and pushed herself upright. She felt weak, and she stumbled once and caught her shin on the table's brass frame. She walked uneasily through Tony's field of fire. Up close, his automatic was huge and brutal. He tracked her with it all the way as she approached Hobie. Back there, she was beyond the reach of the sunbeams. Hobie led her through the gloom and juggled the shotgun up under his arm and grasped the handle and pulled the door open.
"Check the outer door first and then the telephone." That was what she'd been rehearsing as she walked. If she could get out into the public corridor, she might have a chance. Failing that, there was the 911 speed dial. Knock the handset out of the cradle, hit the button, and even if she got no opportunity to speak, the automatic circuitry would give the cops a location. The door or the phone. She rehearsed looking ahead at the door, looking left at the phone, the precise turn of her head in between. But when it came to it, she looked at neither thing. Hobie stopped dead in front of her, and she stepped alongside him, and just looked at the guy who had gone to fetch the coffee. He was a thick-set man, shorter than Hobie or Tony, but broad. He was wearing a dark suit. He was lying on his back on the floor, precisely centered in front of the office door. His legs were straight, his feet were turned out, his head was propped at a steep angle on a stack of phone books. His eyes were wide open. They stared forward, sightlessly. His left arm was dragged up and back, and the hand was resting palm up on another stack of books in a grotesque parody of greeting. His right arm was pulled straight at a shallow angle away from his body. His right hand was severed at the wrist. It was lying on the carpet 6 inches away from his shirt cuff, arranged in a precise straight line with the arm it had come from. She heard Hobie making a small sound in his throat, and turned to see him dropping the shotgun and clutching at the door with his good hand. The burn scars were still vivid pink, but the rest of his face was turning a ghastly white.
CD 14.
Tripwire by Lee Child. Reacher had been named Jack by his father, who was a plain New Hampshire Yankee with an implacable horror of anything fancy. He had walked into the maternity ward one late October Tuesday, the morning after the birth, and he had handed his wife a small bunch of flowers and told her, "We'll call him Jack." There was no middle name. Jack Reacher was the whole of it, and it was already on the birth certificate, because he had visited the company clerk on his way to the infirmary, and the guy had written it down and reported it by telex to the Berlin embassy. Another United States citizen, born overseas to a serving soldier, name of Jack Nunn Reacher. His mother made no objection. She loved her husband for his ascetic instincts because she was French and they gave him a kind of European sensibility that made her feel more at home with him. She had found an enormous gulf between America and Europe in those post-war decades. The wealth and excess of America contrasted uneasily with the exhaustion and poverty of Europe. But her very own New Hampshire Yankee had no use for wealth and excess. No use at all. Plain, simple things were what he liked, and that was absolutely fine with her, even if it did extend all the way to her baby's names. He had called her firstborn Joe. Not Joseph, just Joe. No middle name. She loved the boy, of course, but the name was hard for her. It was very short and abrupt, and she struggled with the initial J because of her accent. It came out like Z. Like the boy was called Joe. Jack was much better. Her accent made it sound like Jacques, which was a very traditional old French name. Translated, it meant James. Privately, she always thought of her second boy as James. But paradoxically, nobody ever called him by his first name. Nobody knew how it came about, but Joe was always called Joe, and Jack was always called Reacher. She did it herself all the time. She had no idea why. She would stick her head out of some service bungalow window and yell, "Joe, come and get your lunch, and bring Reacher with you." And her two sweet little boys would come running inside for something to eat. The exact same thing happened in school. It was Reacher's own earliest memory. He was an earnest, serious boy, and he was puzzled why his names were backward. His brother was called by his first name first and his last name last. Not him. There was a schoolyard softball game, and the kid who owned the bat was choosing up sides. He turned to the brothers and called out, "I'll have Joe and Reacher." All the kids did the same thing. The teachers, too. They called him Reacher, even in kindergarten. And somehow it traveled with him. Like any army kid, he changed elementary schools dozens of times. First day in some new place somewhere, maybe even on a new continent, some new teacher would be yelling, "Come here, Reacher!" But he got used to it fast and had no problem living his whole life behind a one-word name. He was Reacher, always had been, always would be, to everybody. The first girl he ever dated was a tall brunette who sidled shyly up to him and asked, "What's your name?" "Reacher," he replied. The loves of his life had all called him that. "Reacher, I love you," they had whispered in his ear. All of them. Jody herself had done the exact same thing. He had appeared at the top of the concrete steps in Leon's yard, and she had looked up at him and said, "Hello, Reacher." After 15 long years, she still knew exactly what he was called.